Good evening. Mayor de Blasio unveils the city's plan to save Lower Manhattan from rising sea levels and global climate change. And why is the Manhattan DA opposing criminal justice reform? With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the news for Thursday, March 14, 2019. First, to Linda Perry with headlines.
In immigration news, federal authorities say a Bronx man bit off part of an immigration officer's finger during a recent arrest. Court papers released today say the man became combative and ran into a bedroom before biting an ICE officer who was trying to restrain him. The officer was taken to a hospital for treatment. Meanwhile, in response to the Trump administration's immigration policies, the Cuomo administration is expanding state services such as legal representation and community-based assistance for immigrants across New York. Governor Cuomo says one of the new initiatives will help immigrants detained by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. It expands legal assistance provided rapidly to immigrants taken into custody by ICE. The state contracted seven organizations to provide these services, adding to a program that was launched back in December. The other programs create 21 new centers. They will provide legal consultation, naturalization assistance, citizenship preparation classes, and community workshops. Also, other free services to immigrants in their own neighborhoods. This is overseen by the State Office for New Americans. The centers will be located in every region of the state. Meanwhile, in Phoenix, despite more than 100 local governments around the country adopting sanctuary rules to protect immigrants, informal information sharing continues to violate those rules. The chair of the Bernalillo County Commission in California says staff members at the jail in Albuquerque are still giving immigration officials access to information. And the ACLU says in Orange County, California, a detective often looks up license plate information for an immigration officer. In other news, a New York appeals court today ruled that Donald Trump isn't immune from a defamation lawsuit filed by a former Apprentice show contestant who accused him of unwanted kissing and groping. Citing a U.S. Supreme Court ruling two decades ago in a case involving alleged sexual misconduct by Bill Clinton, a majority of judges on the panel said presidents can be sued in state courts over things they did that aren't related to their official duties. The decision increases the prospect that Trump could have to sit for sworn questioning in the lawsuit. It was brought by Summer Zervos. She was among over a dozen women who emerged during the Republican 2016 campaign with allegations of sexual misconduct years earlier. Trump called the women liars. Donald Trump's legal team plans to appeal the ruling. And Tish James, New York's attorney general, says insider testimony, emails, and other evidence support allegations that Donald Trump turned his charitable foundation into a wing of his White House campaign. James detailed her case today in a 37-page court filing in a lawsuit that seeks $2.8 million in restitution and a 10-year ban on Trump and his three eldest children from running any New York charities. Trump and his lawyers say the lawsuit is politically motivated. In a closely watched case by gun reform advocates, the Connecticut Supreme Court ruled that gun maker Remington can be sued over marketing the Bushmaster rifle used to kill 20 children and six educators at Sandy Hook Elementary School in 2012. The plaintiffs include a survivor and relatives of nine people killed in the massacre. They argue the AR-15-style rifle used by shooter Adam Lanza was designed as a military killing machine and that it's too dangerous for the public, but Remington glorified the weapon in marketing it to young people. In other news, students in high schools around the world are planning to skip school on Friday to protest the inaction of governments on climate change and to demand action. More than 1,000 events are planned to protest the government's failure to cut emissions. The protest was begun last year by 15-year-old Greta Thunberg in Sweden. She has continued to inspire students throughout the world. Here she is speaking at the UN COP24 climate conference.
Our civilization is being sacrificed for the opportunity of a very small number of people to continue making enormous amounts of money. Our biosphere is being sacrificed so that rich people in countries like mine can live in luxury. It is the sufferings of the many which pay for the luxuries of the few. The year 2078, I will celebrate my 75th birthday. If I have children, maybe they will spend that day with me. Maybe they will ask me about you. Maybe they will ask why you didn't do anything while there still was time to act. You say you love your children above all else, and yet you are stealing their future in front of their very eyes. Until you start focusing on what needs to be done, rather than what is politically possible, there is no hope. We cannot solve a crisis without treating it as a crisis. We need to keep the fossil fuels in the ground, and we need to focus on equity. And if solutions within this system are so impossible to find, then maybe we should change the system itself. We have not come here to beg world leaders to care. You have ignored us in the past, and you will ignore us again. We have run out of excuses, and we are running out of time. We have come here to let you know that change is coming, whether you like it or not. The real power belongs to the people.
Today, Thunberg tweeted, "Once we start to act, hope is everywhere. So instead of looking for hope, look for action. Then and only then, hope will come." The global climate strike on Friday will involve students from 90 countries and more than 1,200 cities. It could be one of the largest environmental protests in history. 180 events are planned throughout the United States. 2018 was the fourth hottest year on record in almost 140 years, making the last 5 years the hottest in recorded history. Back over to you now, Paul.
Thanks, Linda. Mayor Bill de Blasio unveiled plans Thursday to extend Lower Manhattan into the East River, pushing out the east edge of the downtown coastline as much as two city blocks in a plan that will cost a whopping $10 billion. The massive plan is part of a multi-pronged approach to prevent storm surges and rising sea level from inundating Lower Manhattan. 20% of downtown is expected to flood daily in 100 years, according to the city. The plan invests $500 million towards flood protection measures in the Lower East Side, South Street Seaport, the Financial District, and Battery Park. The mayor had this to say.
Now, global warming is an extraordinary threat to all of our country, all of our earth. But when it comes to New York City, one of the great coastal cities of the world, we are particularly threatened. And nowhere is that threat greater than for the hundreds of thousands of people who live and work in Lower Manhattan. We've been looking at different solutions, and we had to come to grips with the sheer magnitude of what had to be done and the challenge of making it happen in real terms. Because remember, we're talking about a neighborhood, a living, breathing, active neighborhood, where so much has been done for centuries. And our job was to protect that neighborhood, but also recognize that we couldn't disrupt so much that happens there. We also had to think about what would ultimately work against a wide variety of threats. It's not just a superstorm that we fear. It's rising sea levels. And it's a host of other challenges that could lead to making this an area that simply isn't livable. You're going to hear from the president of the Economic Development Corporation, James Patchett, in just a moment on some of the details. But let me give you the headlines now. We will initiate an effort that is estimated to cost $10 billion to extend the shoreline of Lower Manhattan into the East River to protect the seaport area and the financial district and all the people who live and work there. And we are already investing $500 million in four projects to strengthen the Lower Manhattan coastline and provide interim protections. All four of those projects will be under construction in the next 2 years. There will be installation of temporary barriers put in place this year, by the end of this summer, in the area around two bridges, the Financial District, and the Seaport, to protect us this year from this coming hurricane season. Now, this Lower Manhattan Coastal Resiliency Plan is comprehensive, to say the least. It is audacious, but most of all, it is necessary. This is a very, very big undertaking. There's nothing been done like this in the history of New York City, but it is needed. And I want to give you the plain facts that make so clear why we have to do this. This is a city with 4.5 million jobs. 1 in 10 of the jobs in this city are located in Lower Manhattan. 75% of the subway lines in New York City run through Lower Manhattan. There's $60 billion worth of property in Lower Manhattan. As I said, hundreds of thousands of people who live or work there every day. Now, the next point I'm going to make should be something that's talked about not only here, but in our nation's capital. Lower Manhattan is one of the core centers of the American economy, is where the financial capital of the United States is. The security of Lower Manhattan should be a national priority. The fact is, it is not. And it's incomprehensible to me that there's no sense of urgency from the federal government, and there hasn't been, to protect Lower Manhattan and all it means, not only for the city and state, but for this country. Here's the stark reality. Federal funds only come after there's been a disaster. That is the reality of our country right now. There's no plan, there's no vision, there's no funding to actually protect us from what is looming in our future. It's only when the destruction has been done that money eventually starts to flow. We can't live that way anymore. I want to give you an example for anyone who may be thinking right now, well, I just told you about a single initiative that's going to cost $10 billion. Someone might say, well, how on earth are we going to afford this? Here's a fact. From the years of the Iraq War, the United States spent an average of $50 billion a year on that war and did not spend money protecting Americans from global warming. We have to get our priorities right. In the meantime, we have to go at the root cause. To say the least, we would like our national government to focus more on how to stop global warming. But in the meantime, the city of New York is doing all we can, and cities all over the country, over 400 cities, have pledged to live up to the standards of the Paris Agreement. We are cutting emissions 80% by 2050. We're the first major American city to divest our pension fund dollars from fossil fuels companies. That's going to be a $5 billion divestment. We're committed to investing 2% of all of our pension fund money in renewable energy. That's going to be a $4 billion investment. We are doing the things that are needed, but they'll have to be done on a much greater scale, literally, if we are all to survive. We can't afford to bury our head in the sand, and that's right now what our federal government is doing. But we understand we have to make a difference.
The city is kicking in funds for the early stages of the plan, but de Blasio says he aims to foot the bill for the multi-billion-dollar project through state and federal funds. If the federal government doesn't cough up the cash needed for the project, the city will turn to the private sector. And the United States Senate has voted to end U.S. support for the Saudi Arabian-led coalition's war in Yemen, bringing Congress one step closer to an unprecedented rebuke of Donald Trump's foreign policy. But a maneuver by Trump supporters in the House, who tacked on a measure condemning anti-Semitism, forced the bill to be reconsidered and delayed its final passage. Lawmakers have never before invoked a decades-old war powers resolution to stop a foreign conflict, but they are poised to do just that in the effort to cut off U.S. support for a war that has triggered a humanitarian catastrophe. Shireen El-Adin is an assistant professor of education at Michigan State University. She was born and raised in Yemen. She says the bill was aimed at logistical and intelligence support of Saudi Arabia by the United States.
So they just actually passed the resolution in the Senate last night with a vote of 54 to 46. And this would have been, this was a bill that was introduced in the House first, and it passed last month in the House, and it directs President Trump to end hostilities in Yemen. So So we know that the U.S. is involved in the war in Yemen, and it's been increasingly supporting the Saudi-led coalition there, not only with weapons, which the bill doesn't address, but with intelligence and logistics and training and mid-air refueling and so on. So the House initially passed a bill that would prevent Trump from continuing this on, given that it's illegal, actually. The War Powers Act of 1973 prevents the president from being able to declare war. And then the Senate yesterday, last night, passed a similar bill.
I see. So the bill you were mentioning, the Senate bill that was passed, is the Senate version of the House bill. Is that it?
Yes. And it would have been now hopefully on its way to President Trump's office. But there were some maneuverings in the House, and we've seen this before with war powers regarding Yemen, that now prevent it from going forward. And this, what the version that the Senate passed is actually not the exact same, which means it has to go back and pass again in the House. And the reason for that is because GOP leaders at the last minute, after passing the bill in the House, included some language condemning anti-Semitism as an amendment to this bill. Now, because of germaneness laws, laws that say that these bills, if they're going to pass in one chamber from the next, they have to be, you know, pertaining, the amendments have to pertain to the issue itself. Since anti-Semitism has nothing to do with the war in Yemen, the Senate couldn't, in fact, pass the exact same bill as we had hoped, and instead passed a version of it, which now has to go back to the House and be passed again.
I see. And will they pass the – do you expect the House to pass the bill with the language condemning anti-Semitism?
So that already went through, which is why it couldn't go through in the Senate. But now we're hoping that the amendments, as the bill as it is, will just pass again in the House. Without the inclusion of any other amendments that would, not be in relation to the issue itself.
Well, let me clarify that for a second. So it was the Senate who included the anti-Semitism language, forcing the bill to be sent back to the House. I'm correct?
No, the House included the language, and then the Senate was forced to send it back.
I see. Now, why did the House include language on anti-Semitism at the last moment?
So this is, they tried to do it in a rebuke to the Democrats when the whole controversy around Representative Omar happened. But the fact that they included that, they could have tacked it onto any bill or to have a separate bill. The fact that they included it as an amendment to the War Powers Resolution in Yemen, I mean, it makes no sense other than to try to divert again from trying to prevent this war from ending.
What is happening in Yemen right now, and why is this such a pressing, important bill?
Well, the war has not let up. We don't have as many airstrikes that we hear about, at least in the capital city of Sana'a, but the Saudi-led coalition is still waging war in Yemen with extensive support from the United States. They are bombing civilians daily. They were just civilians that were bombed 2 days ago. 14 children were among those killed. And, of course, the thing that's killing Yemenis most of all is the blockade that the Saudis and the Emiratis have imposed on Yemen, so land, air, and sea blockade that prevents the entry of aid and food and medicine, or limits those entries. They've shut down Sana'a Airport and other busy airports in Yemen, and they control the airspace, so people are kind of trapped within and die because they can't access healthcare within the country or outside. And so the situation really is dire. The number of kids who continue to die of starvation has increased. Every 10 minutes, a child dies in Yemen. So the number, and this is, child below the age of 5. So the numbers really are horrific. And tens of thousands of Yemenis have already been killed in the violence. Hundreds of thousands have starved to death. And so this should be an urgent matter, and it should not be a partisan issue. The Senate bill was co-sponsored by Bernie Sanders, an independent, Chris Murphy, a Democrat, and Mike Lee of Utah, who's a Republican. So really, this should have been something that everybody has an interest in passing, given the incredible humanitarian toll. But we've seen such a reluctance to end the cooperation with Saudi Arabia because of how much money is involved in this situation.
So this War Powers Act is really not talking about weapons, but talking about other aspects of U.S. support for Saudi Arabia.
Exactly. Intelligence, logistics, training, refueling, things like that.
Anything you'd like to add?
It's really important to keep the momentum going. So if people could put pressure on their representatives to, again, we're not asking for intervention. This is a please don't intervene in Yemen any longer because of all the mess that we've created. So if people can call their representatives in the next week or so, that would be great.
And there's Shireen Alladeen speaking about the war in Yemen. Trump's support for Saudi Arabia has been a point of tension with Congress since the killing of U.S.-based journalist Jamal Khashoggi last year. Lawmakers from both parties have criticized Trump for not condemning Saudi Arabia strongly enough for the killing. The vote puts Congress on a collision course with Trump, who has already threatened to veto the resolution, which the White House says raises serious constitutional concerns. And in yet another stunning rebuke to the president, a dozen defecting Republicans joined Senate Democrats on Thursday to block the national emergency that President Donald Trump declared he would so he could build his border wall with Mexico. The rejection capped a week of confrontation with the White House as both parties in Congress strained to exert their power in new ways. The 59-41 tally followed the Senate's vote a day earlier to end U.S. involvement in the war in Yemen. And in New York, the civil rights organization Vocal protested at the offices of Manhattan District Attorney Cy Vance Jr. today. They're protesting the DA's opposition to criminal justice reform measures that would make it easier for people arrested to make bail, among other reforms. The DA and his colleagues from around the state have been opposing the measure they say would take away important tools used to win convictions and plea bargains. But Vocal civil rights campaign director Nick Ensalada Malinowski says politicians who claim to be progressive can't play both sides of the street.
Vocal New York, along with a large coalition of groups across New York State, has been fighting this year for criminal justice reform in Albany around bail, discovery, and speedy trial. And the main oppositions to all three of those bills are the district attorneys. So we've seen individual district attorneys, but also the District Attorneys Association of the State of New York, DASNY, really actively lobbying against these bills, calling legislators, working the press, things like that to try and kill the bills. So we have started going, targeting DAs around the state, demanding that they leave DASNY and support our issues. There are several DAs in New York City, but also elsewhere in the state, who claim to be progressive prosecutors, but then on the side are trying to do everything that they can to either kill or gut progressive criminal legislation. And so we're trying to make a point right now that you can't actually do that. You can't sit on both sides of the fence. You can't, on the one hand, run around the country like Cy Vance does, claiming to be a progressive, and then on the other hand, one, not support progressive criminal justice bills, but then also the practices within his office, some of the worst discovery practices in the state. Bail remains a problem in Manhattan. Cy Vance sends more people to Rikers Island than any other DA in New York City. So we are trying to say at the same time, we need him to shape up his shop in New York County, but we also need his support to pass this. We don't need his support to pass this criminal justice reform, but we need him to stop talking to elected officials and trying to convince them to not let these progressive bills pass.
What would progressive criminal justice reform look like in New York?
So we have three bills right now in Albany, a bill that would both eliminate money bail and also create a system where the vast majority of people who go into court, there would never be any conversation about whether they go to jail or not. Right now, a DA and a judge can put you in jail no matter what you do, no matter what your circumstances are. So we would be foreclosing the possibility that the vast majority of people arrested in New York State could ever go to jail. That's a bail bill. The discovery bill, New York is one of four states around the country that does not practice open discovery, which means that district attorneys are allowed to withhold information in a case all the way up until trial. So for the whole time the case is continuing, the defense attorney and the defendant do not have access to all the information that's being used in the case, if there is any information at all. In some cases, there may not be any evidence. And so what our discovery bill would do is set timelines for the prosecutors to hand stuff over. At the very first court date, you got to give us the police report. You got to give us any surveillance videos. You got to give us the stuff that you already have in your office. And then moving forward, 5 days, 10 days, 15 days, 40 days into the case, there are different benchmarks by which other information would have to be provided. You had a case in Cleve Browder's case. 2 years into the case, the prosecutors were finally admitting that they didn't actually have a witness, and that's not right.
Who's Cleve Browder?
Kalief Browder is a young man who was arrested in the Bronx on a charge that he had stolen a backpack from somebody. He was 16 years old. He ended up on Rikers Island for two and a half years in solitary confinement. At the end of the case, the Bronx DA finally said that they did not have a case against him and let him go, dismissing the case. You know, after he spent 3 years locked up as a 16-year-old, and then shortly after getting out of jail, you know, the trauma, you know, losing his whole teenage years to Rikers Island, he ended up killing himself.
Is Rikers Island full of stories like this, or was this a one-off?
Rikers Island is full of stories like this. So not only Rikers Island, but, you know, in jails across New York State, 75% of the people in jails across New York State are there not because they've been convicted of anything, but they're there pre-trial, waiting for their case to be adjudicated, waiting for their, you know, the proverbial day in court, which in most cases never happens. So you have every jail. You know, Rikers Island is a horrible jail, but there's a mini Rikers Island in every county across the state that's filled with people who cannot pay bail, who don't have access to evidence in their cases.
Yeah, what's the logic behind this, especially in a what does New York City, a city of 10 million people, the richest city in North America, what's the benefit of keeping a kid in jail for months and months for a backpack charge? Why would they even do that?
So there's clearly no societal benefit to keeping people in jail like this. The main reason that it happens is about case processing. So, you know, having somebody in jail allows the prosecutor tremendous amount of leverage to adjudicate their cases. So, you know, one of the positions that DASNY, District Attorney Association, State of New York, made about why they need money bail and why they need to be able to keep people in jail is so that they can coerce them towards specific outcomes in the case. So what David Soares, who is the head of DASNY, said was we need bail because we need to be able to threaten people with jail time so that they can you know, go into drug treatment or some other outcome that the DA wants. The reality is that has not ever been the purpose of bail. Right. The purpose of bail historically has been to ensure that people show up to court and meet their obligations to the court. It is not a way for the DAs to put pressure, you know, the kind of pressure where, it's, you know, people die in jail. You know, you're going to lose your house. You're going to lose your job. All these things just to coerce them into taking a plea deal.
Nick Insulata Malinowski is Vocal's civil rights campaign director. And finally, New York City police say the man who fatally shot the reputed boss of the Gambino crime family may have staged a car accident to lure him out of his home. Chief of Detectives Dermot Shea said Thursday police are reviewing surveillance footage that captured the events surrounding Frank Kiley's death Wednesday night in Staten Island. She described the shooter as an adult male who sped off in a pickup truck. At least 12 shots were fired. There have been no arrests. The Gambino crime family is one of the five families that dominate organized crime in New York City. The families are often referred to as the Mafia or Cosa Nostra. Carlo Gambino was boss of the family in 1963 during Senate hearings on organized crime in the United States. Its illicit activities include labor and construction racketeering, gambling, loan sharking, extortion, money laundering, prostitution, fraud, hijacking, and fencing stolen goods. Among its famous members was Albert Anastasio, who formed the underworld hit team called Murder, Inc. in the 1940s, and John Gotti, the Teflon Don, operating out of Ozone Park. Gotti died in prison in 2002. We'll be having more on this story tomorrow on the WBAI Evening News. And that's some of the news for Thursday, March 14th, 2019. The news was produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is James Irsay. For the WBAI Evening News, I'm Paul DiRienzo in New York.